Como down there in Port St. Lucie covers the Mets for MLB.com. Mets.com does a great job. Hey, Anthony, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lori. Do you have me now?
Ah, perfect.
There we go. I'm happy to be here.
I was feeling it was a little bit of an underwhelming, and the murderer is dun dun dun, and then there's like silence. Yeah, no, but there you are. So, let's start off with today. I mean, obviously, it's been pitchers and catchers, and I want to talk all about that. But a story that got a lot of attention with the Mets. 2024, they were the OMG Mets, great vibes, all of that. 2025, and it's an interesting thing. When you win, the vibes are great. You lose, not so good. But we hear about and find out about the 2025 Mets. The chemistry wasn't there. And David Stearns, obviously, is the president of baseball operations, made a lot of changes to this Mets team for a number of reasons and changed them in many ways. But this chemistry issue was sort of a reason, at least one reason, to also want to break up this core. Lindor and Soto there talking to the media for the first time this spring today, and they gave different answers on this chemistry issue. Can you bring us up to date on the contrasts and also what it maybe tells us about both players?
Yeah, look, I think Francisco Lindor and Juan Soto are very different personalities. And I think that is a big explanation for why their answers were different. In some sense, their answers were the same in that both of them kind of said, we're moving on. Neither of them really said we didn't have a problem. But I think people from the outside tend to look at this in very black and white. Like, either you're the 2024 OMG Mets and the chemistry is amazing and everything's hunky-dory and all that, or you have a toxic clubhouse. The reality is that most clubhouses are somewhere in between, and I would put the 2025 Mets in that bucket as well. I don't think they had a toxic clubhouse. I think they had a couple of stars in Lindor and Soto that maybe weren't the best friends in the world, that were trying to feel each other out in terms of being kind of those, you know, big dogs in a clubhouse. Lindor sort of being the de facto captain for several years, and then Soto coming in on the largest contract in professional sports history. And I think a lot of people assumed that he would take on some leadership over time, and he did start to do that. So I think you have all of that. You had the departures of a couple of key veterans from the 24 team and Jose Iglesias and JD Martinez and some other key leaders like Sean Manaea was hurt for a lot of the year. So there was a lot going on that it became difficult for the Mets to replicate that 2024 success. Again, does that mean it was a toxic clubhouse? No, I truly don't believe that. I was in there almost every day last season. I saw what went on. I didn't see any signs of a bad clubhouse. It just wasn't what they had previously. And there is always that aspect of the chicken and the egg. Right? Right. What breeds what? Does winning breed chemistry? Does chemistry breed winning? I mean, I don't think anyone thought the 2024 Mets clubhouse was special until about late May, early June when they started winning. Before that, it was just another team. So there's an element of all of that involved. I will say this, though. As you mentioned at the outset, this is a very different Mets team. For better or for worse, Pete Alonso is gone, Brandon Nimmo is gone, Jeff McNeil is gone, Edwin Diaz is gone. I mean, you're talking about guys with a combined 30-plus years of tenure in the major leagues. For most of them, the bulk, if not all of it, with the Mets. There is going to be some feeling out in this clubhouse this spring and probably into the season. You still have Lindor, you still have Soto, but you've got some other big names and guys who have served as leaders in other places. Marcus Semien jumps to mind. Bo Bichette is a veteran at this point, and he's here on a big contract. So there is going to be this feeling out period where people figure out how this team's going to gel, how they're going to mesh. At the end of the day, if the team plays well, I firmly believe that the chemistry will be good. And if the team plays poorly, I'm not sure it'll be amazing. But I do think this thought that Francisco Lindor and Juan Soto cannot coexist, I don't think that's true. They're different personalities. They're probably never going to be best friends. But that doesn't mean they can't do a lot of winning together.
In terms of Lindor and you know, obviously there's the issue with the hand, and now, you know, he had surgery. I've had Mets fans reach out to me about this. Any sense that the Mets, you know, speaking of OMG chemistry 2024, that as the Mets look for options and depth at shortstop and not wanting to potentially rush Lindor back for opening day, maybe needs an extra couple weeks, any potential that they would bring a player like Iglesias on a, you know, minor league contract, non-guaranteed type of, you know, a minor league contract with an invite to spring training? Any possibility there?
I really don't see it for a couple of reasons. One, you know, Jose Iglesias had a career year in 2024. He was not the same player in 2025. I just don't see David Stearns looking at that. And again, a year ago, he didn't want to sign Jose Iglesias, much to the consternation of many people in the Mets fan base. I don't see him turning around now and viewing Iglesias as a better option than Ryan Mauricio or Vidal Brujan or Greg Kessinger, any of these guys that he brought in this offseason, for exactly this reason. I mean, the Mets do have six or seven guys in camp right now who can play shortstop. I think maybe the situation across the roster would be different if there was a thought that Lindor would potentially miss months. But as you said, if he's not there on opening day, he should be there very shortly thereafter. So you'd be looking at someone filling in for a week, something like that. So no, I don't see Iglesias as a realistic option at this point.
So amongst all the changes, there weren't just changes to the roster. There was also, you know, Carlos Mendoza may need name tags also for his coaching staff and to introduce new people there as well. For Mets fans who are less familiar with their new hitting coach, Troy Snitaker, obviously they know the last name know that name in terms of the Braves and his father. But what can you tell Mets fans about Troy Snitaker and how what to expect from him as a hitting coach and anything that might be similar or different than what Mets fans are used to?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that fans are going to notice on a day-to-day that's significantly different. Snitaker is going to be working under Jeff Albert, who is the director of hitting development, and he's been in the organization for a few years now. He's going to be in uniform as well. So it's sort of like the hitting intelligentsia. And, you know, I can't speak right now as to Snitaker's specific philosophies, but I can say this. And I would say the same thing about Justin Willard, the new pitching coach, and really across the board, one of the things that this coaching staff is stressing, and not that the previous one didn't, but is this idea that one size doesn't fit all, right? Like what works for Francisco Lindor doesn't necessarily work for Juan Soto. What works for Juan Soto doesn't necessarily work for Brett Beatty, and go on down the line. So it's much more of an individualistic approach for all guys. This is an offense that wasn't bad last year. They weren't great. And I think when you look and you see that they have Juan Soto and Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso and Brendan Nimmo, and these are the names on the backs of the jerseys of the 2025 Mets. Like I went into last year thinking it would be one of the best in the National League, if not
right.
Probably top, second
top
best to the Dodgers.
Yeah. For sure. A top five offense, at top three, even probably top three offense. Yeah.
They wound up being a lot closer to league average, and now, you know, you got rid of Pete Alonso, right? You got rid of Brandon Nimmo. You brought in a former all-star, but a older bat in Marcus Semien. You brought in an interesting bat in Bo Bichette, who's not quite the mold you've had around here very often, a guy who's hit first, hit over power. Not that Bo Bichette can't hit the ball out of the ballpark, but he's a guy who can really put the ball in play and do that well. So you're not going to coach him the same way that you would coach Pete Alonso. You're not going to coach Bo Bichette the same way that you would coach Juan Soto. So I think that's really what this staff is stressing, is that we're going to do what works for each individual guy. And for some guys, that might mean, you know, taking a more aggressive approach. For some guys, that might mean using the whole field. For some guys, it might mean trying to pull balls in the air. There's no one-size-fits-all, and I personally think that is the right approach.
Talking to Anthony DiComo, does a great job covering the Mets. And you mentioned Bo Bichette, and Bo Bichette, one of a handful of players that, you know, part of why David Stearns wanted to transform this team and the score. Like, yeah, there was the chemistry thing, but a bigger part of it, we heard him right away talking about wanting to improve this team defensively, run prevention, as well as I think he did want to, you mentioned Bo Bichette and his approach, and it's, you know, diversifying this offense a little bit. And so with Bo Bichette and the first one here of players now that are learning new positions, what have you seen so far? Because I understand players are just reporting, but Bo Bichette, we've seen videos out of spring training, has been down there at least a few days working defensively. What has stood out to you watching Bo Bichette trying to break in as a third baseman?
Honestly, the thing that stood out to me most was Bo Bichette's first day here taking part of workouts, and he's out there at third base taking ground balls, and Carlos Mendoza is standing right behind him, and not just standing behind him, but literally, you know, putting his hands on Bo Bichette, positioning him in certain ways, talking to him after every ground ball, giving tips. And Mendoza, you know, you might know, is a minor league third baseman and shortstop himself, so he's got experience at both positions, but it's not something you necessarily see from Carlos Mendoza, getting that down and dirty. That tends to be more the purview of his coaches, and the Mets have infield coaches. Kai Correa, you know, is that guy for the Mets, and he was out there as well working with Bichette. But Carlos Mendoza was pretty hands-on, literally. And I think that speaks to how important this transition is to them. They're taking this very seriously. They would say the same about Jorge Polanco at first base and any number of guys that are playing quote unquote out of position for the Mets. You said it from the beginning of the offseason, Lori. David Stearns made it very clear that what he wanted to do was improve the Mets' run prevention. And that means pitching. And mm-hmm. you know, picking up Freddy Peralta is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. But it also means defense in a big way. And this hasn't historically for years been a great mm-hmm. defensive team. The Mets want it to be better. I think there's a lot of skepticism out there that it can be better when you have guys like Bichette and Polanco not just playing out of position, but playing positions they've never played in their professional careers. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it goes. Spring training is the time to make mistakes. You will see both of those players make mistakes on defense. Again, Polanco has never played first base except for, I believe, one out in his career. Bichette has never played third base ever in his professional career. So they're going to break him in, and there's going to be mistakes even when you get into the regular season. But the Mets signed those guys to play those positions for a reason. They do think they're both capable, and it's going to be, for my money, something very interesting to watch all year, because if it works, the Mets have a much better chance of being a good, solid overall team and a playoff team and a team that can do damage than if it doesn't. It's not as sexy as sitting here and saying how many home runs is Bo Bichette going to hit, how many stolen bases is you know, whatever. But it does matter in a lot of ways just as much.
It's interesting is if we take David Stearns at his word and run prevention, which is also pitching, you're right, and they trade for Freddy Peralta, obviously to be a terrific starting pitcher. But if we take that defense, run prevention, part of it as being so important to David Stearns, do you find it, like, in other words, is there some ulterior motive, or what was the agenda with some of the transformation? Could it really be so much of it run prevention when they bring in players that have never played those positions before? If you really were so focused on defense, wouldn't you have taken a slightly different approach? Or how do you interpret this? Was this also about being flexible and versatile with where the market went, and you have to adapt, and you may have had a certain image in mind of how it might go, but now this is not our ideal scenario. It's not perfect run prevention, and we have to put in some bats here and hope the defense improves.
Yeah, it's a little of both, and the Mets didn't know what the market would look like, how it would turn out when they set about the offseason. They signed Jorge Polanco very early with an idea of playing him at first base, but they also didn't know what was going to happen at that point with other players on the free agent market, and if that would really come to pass, or they had the flexibility to play Polanco at DH most days, and they still do, if that's the way they want to play it. In the case of Bo Bichette, I think, you know, when you got to around Christmas time, I don't think David Stearns was, I know David Stearns wasn't sitting there saying, Bo Bichette's the guy we're going to get. In fact, the Mets moved and asked Juan Soto if he would move from right field to left field, and part of the reason why was because Kyle Tucker was out there. The Mets were interested in Kyle Tucker, and they definitely thought there was a chance that Kyle Tucker was going to be their everyday right fielder. They got out in front of that. They do think Juan Soto can potentially help them more in left field and right field, but it wasn't just about Soto. It was about the idea of getting Kyle Tucker. When that didn't happen, the Mets very quickly pivoted to Bo Bichette. And, you know, obviously you have Francisco Lindor here. You already had Marcus Semien at second, so the only place for Bichette to play was third base. This isn't something they said about last October and said, we want to sign Bo Bichette to play third base. That's the way the cards fell. That's not to say they wouldn't have done it if they didn't think it could work. Bo Bichette wasn't a great defensive shortstop during his career there. I think there's a thought that, you know, some of his range issues can be mitigated by a move to third base and things of that nature. But it's always part science, part art when you're a front office trying to figure out what's going on. And you can say you want to improve run prevention. That doesn't mean it's a guarantee, and you can try things that don't necessarily work. That's all kind of why I said in my previous answer, Lori, that this is a fascinating thing to me, a fascinating aspect of the 2026 Mets, because if it works, that's going to be really, really important for them. And if it doesn't, I think a lot of people are going to have questions as to why this is the route they took, because I agree with you. On the surface, you say, okay, we want to improve your run prevention. Then you sign guys for both corner infield spots who have never played there. It does raise some eyebrows and say, well, is this going to work? I guess we'll find out.
Reminds me a little bit of David Stearns in 2024 signing some pitchers with some question marks in Severino and Manaea, and he looks like the smartest guy in the room. And then in 2025... signed some question marks, it doesn't work out, and ultimately with some injuries and things in the second part of the season, it doesn't work out, and now he doesn't look like the smartest guy in the room. So feels like this is going to go one of those two ways. It's either going to work out, and in places that it doesn't, they'll have backup plans for depth that will work out, whether that's first base, let's say, or whatever it is. So he'll either once again be the smartest guy in the room, or people will be coming on the radio and on social media with pitchforks and thinking
this is New York City. There's no in between. You can't be the 100th smartest guy in the room. You're either the most or the least.
Right. So we see it heading towards that. Another obviously interesting storyline as we look ahead. I think you wrote a column on interesting storylines, but how about an update on Kodai Senga, a pitcher that I think a lot of Mets fans were thinking might get traded away in the offseason. How does he look so far?
So far, so good. I always take everything you see here. I mean, we're in February still. I take it with a grain of salt. That being said, you know, Kodai Senga was out throwing a bullpen session the other day. He hit 92 miles an hour, which may not seem like much when I say it right now, but that's not something that most guys, even guys who throw hard, really do at this point in the spring. It tends to be a lot of easing into it, and then once the games start, you see the velocity ratchet up a little bit. I mean, I don't know if people remember last year, there was, Edwin Diaz was topping out at 91, 92 miles an hour, even well into March, and people were freaking out a little. So velo tends to come later for pitchers, later in spring training. And Carlos Mendoza said, you know, he thought it was pretty telling that Kodai Senga was letting it eat a little bit in that bullpen session, mm-hmm. because there has been a hesitancy with him in the past to do that, especially when he's not feeling 100%, when he's not feeling like his mechanics are in sync. And while everyone is trying to get their mechanics in sync this time of year, you know, he's sort of, it almost feels like he's putting that aside and maybe stepping out of his comfort zone a little bit. And if you're the Mets, that can only be a good thing, because we've seen what the other thing looks like, right? We've seen what it looks like when Senga is maybe not feeling the greatest, when he's not, feeling like his mechanics are where they need to be. And either he's been completely unwilling to pitch in major league games in those cases, or he has tried and honestly failed in those cases. So the fact that he's doing it now, I think, is a good sign for the Mets. What it means in terms of him having a good season, I have no idea, Lori. The range of outcomes for this guy is back to being the all-star pitcher that he was in 2023, or you know, could be unpitchable because that's what he was towards the end of last season and everything in between. So I don't think the Mets necessarily are looking for him to be an ace. They would love for him to be an ace. But if he could just settle in where he is a quality, usable major league pitcher again, where he can consistently get guys out, you can start him every 5 days or every 6 days, I should say, and and make it work, I think the Mets would be thrilled with that outcome.
Anything that you're noticing already out of Freddy Peralta, new Met Freddy Peralta? You mentioned Sean Manaea as somebody who really we saw when healthy 2 years ago looked like the kind of the emotional leader of that pitching staff. What are you seeing so far from Freddy Peralta, both as a person, how he interacts with teammates from the little you've seen, and just how he goes about his business or how he's throwing?
Yeah, I think we all know, you know, Freddy Peralta, the pitcher. I don't think there's anyone around here has any doubts that he's going to be a legitimate frontline starter for the Mets. You know, if not an ace, a very, very solid number two. For me, it's more about what he's brought so far inside the clubhouse. Someone described him to me the other day as the type of guy who can kind of connect the entire clubhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, Latin guys, American guys, guys from all different backgrounds, guys from all different skill levels. You do see him bouncing around that room, a room in which he doesn't know that many people yet, and making connections. So that can only be a good thing for the Mets, especially to have a player of that stature doing that. And this is a veteran starting staff right now. You know, in addition to Peralta, you mentioned Sean Manaea, who has taken on a leadership role for sure in the time that he's been here. David Peterson is now the longest tenured Met, and I see him going around and mentoring younger players, and he's taking on a leadership role. I mean, I remember when he was a rookie, the time flies. Clay Holmes is that guy. So, you know, you've got a lot of players, a lot of starting pitchers here who are taking on those little bits and pieces. And then, you know, you've got Nolan McClain, who's a rookie. He seems like he's been in the league for 10 years if you look at him and watch him go about his business. But there's a lot of young pitching prospects coming up too, you know, Jonah Tongchief among them. So having those sorts of stable veteran presences, and Peralta is another of those, can only help.
Yeah, I have to admit, when they made the trade for Peralta, I was also thinking that with Devin Williams, and we all saw him struggle at first with the Yankees and then ultimately settle in, but if you wanted him to be comfortable now with no Edwin Diaz, if he's going to be the closer for the Mets, one way to have him be comfortable, you would think, a guy like Peralta, who he would know from their time with the Brewers, I thought that could be a potential secondary benefit to having a Peralta around with a Devin Williams.
Well, there's a lot of Brewers in here. Those two, Tobias Myers also came over in the trade. You know, you've got Tyrone Taylor, who's been here for several years. So yeah, it is a little bit of a Brewers East out here in Port St. Lucie right now.
Last one before I let you go. You mentioned some of those young players and the veterans mentoring them. I would guess that one storyline or something you will be following, and I'm sure, and I know Mets fans, a fun part of spring training is that the Mets suddenly are this team. David Stearns has been working on it, and you know, credit to others that were previously drafted, other players, but in terms of the farm system and player development, that the Mets now have this top 10 farm system, even though they're trading away top prospects. So How, if at all, does spring training feel different? And are there any stories or, I don't know, with some of these, all these young players that are a part of, that you're already seeing show up at spring training, anybody who, based on personality, stands out or anything that you're seeing amongst that whole crew of young prospects?
Well, what stands out to me is every year, you know, teams, the Mets included, will invite many of their top prospects to spring training, at least the older ones. And it often feels like, okay, we'll see these guys for a couple weeks in February. Maybe they last into March, and then who knows after that. This is a year, I don't want to say the only time, but it's relatively rare where I look around that room and I look at the temporary lockers in the middle of the clubhouse, which is where all the prospects are housed, and almost every single one of them you can look at and say, this guy's got a chance to be a part of this, truly, and this guy has got a chance to be a part of this probably as soon as this year. You know, go on down the line, and I could name names, but, you know, Mets fans already know.
Carson Benj is the obvious one, you know, obviously for the position players. I think fans are excited. May even break camp with them, right?
Absolutely, and if everything goes as the Mets want it to go, which isn't a guarantee by any means, but he'd be starting in right field on opening day. And if he's not starting in right field on opening day, he'll probably be up pretty early in the season, assuming he does what everyone expects him to do in the minors. So you've got Benj, you've got Jonah Tong, who's already been up. You've got younger guys like A.J. Ewing and Nick Morabito, Ryan Clifford, some of these guys who have been kicking around the minors and really starting to make a name for themselves. And I think most people expect them to be lineup regulars, you know, within a couple of years, if not sooner. It is an exciting time because the Mets haven't had a farm system like this. And since Steve Cohen bought the team in 2020, and every GM under him has said the same thing, that they want to build a sustainable system where you're bringing guys up regularly from the farm. It feels now like it's finally starting to bear that fruit. You know, they need more. It's not quite there yet. Nolan McLean's development, Jonah Tong, like, these are really good signs. They definitely need more pitching to come from within, and there's plenty of candidates who could be those guys. Position player side is looking bright as well. But this is where the Mets want to be. They don't want to have to go out and spend huge money in free agency every year. They have the resources to do it, but no team wants to do that. What you want to do is to get your best players developed through your farm system, and it looks like the Mets are doing a better job of that now than they have done in many, many years.
Anthony DiComo does a great job of covering the Mets for MLB.com. Anthony, appreciate the time. Enjoy the glorious weather down there in Florida while we look at brown snow here in New York. But baseball is coming back, and that's always a good sign of spring and things to come. Thanks so much, and we'll catch up with you soon.
You got it. Take care, Lori.